Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with op-ed columnist Thomas Friedman about America's decline and possible recovery.
We are big believers that America really is the tent pole that holds up the world. And if it buckles or splinters, your kids won't just grow up in a different America. They'll grow up in a different world.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. Times columnist Bill Keller surveys the career of Christopher Hitchens.
He embraced America in a way that a lot of those other writers have not, and has almost become a defender of a kind of America that suits him.
And Jennifer Schuessler has bestseller news. Thomas Friedman is one of America's most influential columnists and political thinkers. He's also a best-selling author, and he's got a new book. It's called That Used to Be Us, How America Fell Behind in the World It Invented and How We Can Come Back. It's reviewed on our cover by David Frum, who says there is a lot to like and admire in this book. It is progressive and liberal in the best senses of both those words. It is a book that is at once enlightened and enlightening. I'm delighted that Tom Friedman is joining us from the Washington Bureau of the Times. Welcome, Tom.
Sam, great to be with you.
All right. First, very simple question. You have a co-author, Michael Mandelbaum. Why did the two of you write this book together?
Well, Michael and I have a over 20-year friendship, and we also happen to be neighbors. And basically, Sam, for the last 20 years, we've been carrying on almost a daily dialogue to the frustration some days of our wives. And we talk every morning really about the headlines. We talk about the world. We talk about foreign policy. Michael teaches foreign policy at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and has written many books on foreign policy. And what we noticed over the last couple of years, though, was that we would start every conversation talking about something going on in the world, but we would always end up talking about America. We eventually realized that America, its fate, future, vigor, and vitality, really was the biggest foreign policy issue in the world. That we are big believers that America really is the tent pole that holds up the world. And if it buckles or splinters, your kids won't just grow up in a different America. They'll grow up in a different world. And so we decided that if we were going to be able to continue to be able to write and talk about foreign policy, we really had to write about America.
Tom, a lot of your readers, and there are millions of them, will know that Michael Mandelbaum is often cited in your columns. They're also aware that you've had a number of major bestsellers in which you have looked at rising powers like China and India. It's interesting, now you're looking inward. When was America at its peak, and when did the decline begin, and how?
Well, we basically argue that the biggest mistake America made, it's a mistake that is most dangerous for any country or species, was at the end of the Cold War. We interpreted the end of the Cold War as a victory, and it was a victory, and a victory of ideas, most of all. And fortunately, that victory liberated 2 billion people just like us to compete, connect, and collaborate with us. Only they came to this new world with enormous pent-up aspiration. And so just when we needed to be kind of lacing up our shoes and running the race a little faster, we really put our feet up during that decade of the 90s, which really was made possible thanks to the peace dividend and another huge dividend, which isn't discussed much. You know, the price of oil collapsed with the collapse of the Soviet Union. And so we all got a huge tax cut as oil, you know, got down to $10 a barrel at one point almost. So that was one thing. And then unfortunately, we compounded it in the second decade after the Cold War. Tragically, because of 9/11, we really had to spend the last decade to some degree chasing the losers from globalization, called Al-Qaeda, and the jihadists, rather than the winners, called India and China. And the combination of the two really put us off our game.
So what do we do now?
Well, you know, what we argue, Sam, is that we didn't get here by accident as a country. We really believe that America has a formula for success that dates back to Hamilton and Lincoln, and it's been repeated by every successful president. That formula basically has five pillars. Educate our people up to and beyond whatever the level of technology is, whether it's the cotton gin or the supercomputer, so they can use and exploit them. Second, open our country to the world's most talented and energetic immigrants. Third, have the world's best infrastructure. Fourth, have the best rules to incent capital investing and risk-taking and prevent recklessness, and lastly, government-funded research. We really believe that formula is the core of what made us successful as a country. We had the greatest public-private partnership, and you need both in order to thrive as a country. And we feel that what's happened in the last decade in particular, which we call the terrible twos, this first decade of the 21st century, is that if you look at all those five pillars of our success, the arrow's pointing down on all five. And what we need to do, we believe, is reinvest in all of them, re-energize and reinvigorate them.
Tom, when you mention these five pillars and the vision that great leaders like Hamilton and Lincoln had, that's a vision that at this political juncture is becoming increasingly hard to sell. Why don't you talk about the political condition of America right now, particularly our two parties?
Well, let me try to answer that question by backing into it, if I could, Sam, because one of the things we've tried to do in writing this book is demonstrate in how we write this book how we would love to see the dialogue at the political level, because we understand there's partisanship and we're all for partisanship. That's part of our politics. We just want people to be partisan over the right things. And what's frustrated us is that we really believe America is not starting, you know, the sort of the political discussion in the right place. Where's the right place? What world are we living in? What world are we living in? What is the biggest trend in this world? Well, we believe the biggest trend in this world is actually not 9/11. It's 11/9. You know, 11/9, November 9th, 1989, that's the day the Berlin Wall came down. And ultimately, the fall of the wall and the rise of the web, we believe, is the biggest thing happening in the world today. And what's happened under kind of the umbrella of talking about 9/11 and the subprime crisis, Sam, we've actually gone from a connected world to a hyper-connected world. I worked in 2004 on a book, The World is Flat. That's when I started it, arguing that we're entering a connected world. And when Michael and I started this book, I called him up one day and I said, you know, Michael, I was looking back at The World is Flat first edition, and I realized that I went in the index, Facebook wasn't in it. Facebook didn't exist. Twitter was a sound. The cloud was in the sky. 4G was a parking place. LinkedIn was a prison. Applications were what you sent to college. And for most people, Skype was a typo. All of that changed in 6 years. So we actually, Sam, we went from connected to hyper-connected. Now, what does that mean? What that means is if you're an employer now, you now have access to so much automation, so much great software, so many cheap robots, and not only cheap labor from abroad, but cheap genius from abroad. And what that means is that everyone's got to raise their game. And that's why a lot of this book is really just about education and what we need to do. And maybe the key chapter there is called Average is Over. Because we really believe in this hyper-connected world where bosses can get talent from so many machines and so many other people, average is officially over. Everyone's got to discover their extra. And that's really a lot where our education system needs to go. To us, this is the biggest trend going on in the world. And gosh, Republicans and Democrats can come at that trend however they want. But where we can't start the discussion is by arguing whether or not Social Security is a Ponzi scheme, you know, or whether climate change is real or not. We believe climate change is real. We can argue a lot over what to do about it and how we should respond, adapt or mitigate or whatever. But what we've really tried to do is base the discussion of our book on what is the biggest thing happening in the world. Because if America can't rise to that big challenge, then we really can't be the country we need to be and that the world needs us to be.
And Tom, last question, what's the best thing we have going for us now? So many Americans say they don't like where the country is headed, you know, striking numbers, disapproval of both political parties, the entire political system is so high. What is the thing we can find in ourselves that can turn this around?
Well, we have a chapter on that. It's called They Just Didn't Get the Word. Because, Sam, what I really believe is that this country, and I believe it from my own reporting, is full of people who just didn't get the word. God bless them. They didn't get the word that we're down and out. They didn't get the word that we're politically divided. They didn't get the word that China is going to rule the 21st century. And they just go out and start stuff and invent stuff and create stuff and organize stuff and fix stuff and heal stuff without anybody telling them to or anybody asking them to. There's still tremendous bottom-up energy in this country. And really, if I were to draw a picture of America today, and we say this in the book, it would really be a picture of the space shuttle taking off. You know, the space shuttle, all that incredible thrust coming from below. That's all those people down there who didn't get the word and are just doing it. But unfortunately, with our space shuttle right now, the booster rocket is cracked and leaking energy, and the pilots in the cockpit are fighting over the flight plan. So we can't achieve the escape velocity we need to get into the next century in the way we can be, must be, and need to be. And so what this book is really about is that thrust, what's cracked that booster rocket, and how we can get the pilots in the cockpit to stop fighting over the flight plan. If there's one quote, is my favorite in this book, it was from a Marine colonel we interviewed about Iraq and asked him, why did the Marines surge in Iraq? And he said, Tom, we were too dumb to quit. God, I love that. This country is still full of people just too dumb to quit. And we owe them, it seems to me, a public-private partnership that can really enhance, enable, and nurture all that energy in the right direction.
Thanks so much, Tom.
Pleasure.
That's Thomas Friedman, whose new book, That Used to Be Us, is reviewed on the cover of this week's book review. Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
So, the 10th anniversary of 9/11, there's no getting around it. And I imagine publishers have got their eye on it or have had their eyes on it for quite some time.
They do. And they've been publishing 9/11 books since, you know, almost immediately after the attacks of September 11th. There was a huge rush in the immediate weeks and months after the attacks to sign up books, to find authors who knew anything about Al-Qaeda or global terrorism. But now, because publishers love anniversaries and they are always hoping for some publicity for their books around the anniversary, they've released a whole new crop of books timed to the 10th anniversary of September 11th.
Julie, there's a lot of talk about a book called Black Banners. What's the story there?
This is a book released by Norton, and it just came out this week. It's by Ali Sufan. It's a memoir, and the author is a former FBI agent who played a very central role in terrorism investigations between 1997 and 2005. And this book was redacted by the CIA, and it also made front page news because of those redactions, which were quite extensive.
Julie, this book has actually made headlines. Now, we know the CIA occasionally does edit, we'll put it charitably, books that are dealing with the agency published by CIA officers. But what's the particular interest here? Why is this causing the stir? Are there revelations or news about counterterrorism?
There are. And the author, was very, very involved in a lot of terrorism investigations. And what the CIA usually says that it's redacting for is for classified information. Now, what the author and publisher say is that the CIA went far beyond that and that they redacted information that was not classified.
Any other interesting books?
There are some books that were reissued that might come to mind. One of them is a Simon & Schuster book called What We Saw, which is a detailed account of September 11th with pictures, with video, and they've also updated that. Also, one book that is certainly familiar, The Looming Tower by Lawrence Wright, has been reissued. Norton, again, issued the 9/11 Commission Report, which was probably the best-selling September 11th book in the last 10 years, and they've released it with a new afterword by Philip Zelikow, the executive director of the 9/11 Commission.
Julie, this is a momentous event, but it's also a traumatic one, especially for those of us, and many do, who remember it. So how does a bookseller or a bookstore handle books like these? Obviously, they don't want to promote them in the way they would a celebrity biography or memoir.
They're treading very carefully. Barnes & Noble told me they are, of course, one of the last national bookstore chains in this country. Barnes & Noble said that there's going to be a display in all of their stores throughout the month of September. While near the front of the stores, it'll be discreet. They'll only have about 8 or 9 titles. They're not going to splash the covers in their windows. Other bookstores, independent bookstores, told me that they're going to make make it clear to their customers that these titles are available. One store called Bookhouse in Albany said that they're doing a huge window display featuring about a dozen titles, but they're not doing it because they actually expect to sell books. They're just doing it out of a sense that they should commemorate the event and the anniversary.
Hard to believe it's been 10 years.
It is.
Thanks so much, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
Christopher Hitchens is one of the English language's premier journalists and essayists, who has reached, as our listeners will know, a painful juncture in his life. He is dying of cancer. He's written about it very bravely. He's also collected many of his essays from the past several years in a huge book called Arguably, Essays by Christopher Hitchens. It's reviewed for us by the one and only Bill Keller, who's here to talk about it. Welcome, Bill.
Nice to be here.
Okay, Hitchens, there's so much to say about him. Let's begin with one point. He has a section. The book is so big, he's subdivided it. And one of the sections, I believe the very first, is called All American. Mm-hmm. And in your review, you talk about Hitchens' interesting transformation from Anglo-American journalist to American. How mm-hmm. does that show in the work?
That, to me, it sets him apart from the Martin Amis, Ian McEwan, James Fenton, the erudite Brits that he's often associated with and that he's friends with. He's lived in the States for about 30 years and about four or five years ago decided to take citizenship. He kept his British citizenship, but he embraced America in a way that a lot of those other writers have not, and has almost become a defender of a kind of America that suits him. Obviously, it's not everybody's America. It's a devoutly secular America, among other things. And he's famously an atheist and provocatively an atheist. He loves the pluralism. He loves the comparative newness of the country. He still feels a kind of pioneering, entrepreneurial, political spirit in the place, although he sees a lot of the politics he doesn't like, whereas, you know, his native country is much more settled. He tends to admire the kind of rascals in history, the revolutionaries. It's not surprising, for example, that he is a great admirer of Jefferson. He wrote a small, well-reviewed biography of Jefferson. It's not surprising that he would like Ben Franklin and John Adams and Tom Paine. But he also is an ardent admirer of John Brown, who even a lot of people who would agree with Hitchens on all the others think of as something of a terrorist, you know, the violent abolitionist. He, I think, finds, you know, in a lot of the literature of America, from sort of Twain through Dos Passos, a kindred spirit, something that speaks to him. And so he's both embracing America and a little bit trying to define it in his terms.
Bill, something you say in the essay is that Hitchens really does have a distinct philosophy or ideology, because this question has come up. He's so brilliant a polemicist and so deft an arguer that whatever issue he takes up at any given moment, he'll argue with the same ferocity and erudition that he might have used a few years earlier to make the opposite point. And right. What are the series of beliefs that you've identified as being really central to Hitchens' thought?
They're fairly obvious. I mean, it's been observed before that his kind of touchstone is George Orwell. And you see that throughout this book. I mean, Orwell, there's one essay that is an introduction to Animal Farm. There are references to Orwell's essays. There are footnotes to Orwell. He occasionally picks up Orwell's criticism of a piece of literature and uses it as a foil. I mean, Orwell embodies much of what he admires. And I don't hold with the people who think that he's just a provocateur or a dilettante. I think there is a core of convictions. I mean, he will, you know, rise to any argument, but there is a consistency in here, and it is secularism, anti-fascism. He has a line in the introduction that says that he has been anti-communist, anti-imperialist, and anti-fascist. But when he has to choose, he goes with the anti-fascist or the anti-totalitarian. And Orwell, I think, would have bought that too.
You say anti-pacifist as well.
And anti-pacifist. He believes in activist government. I mean, he clearly, as did Orwell, believes that governments have some responsibility for the poor and the helpless. He also believes in very much in an activist foreign policy, something that I think for a lot of people was crystallized by September 11th, in his case was additionally crystallized by the fatwa against his close friend Salman Rushdie, which made the whole thing kind of personal. So he has been an ardent supporter of the American military ventures in Afghanistan and Iraq and continues to this day to support both of them, has written fairly recently that to some degree, the overthrow of Saddam Hussein enabled the Arab Spring, which I find unconvincing, but at least you have to credit him with consistency.
Bill, what about Hitchens, the literary man? He's so prolific. Is he also someone who's learning new things, or is he like some very well-educated people drawing on the same body of knowledge in essay after essay? Do you sense him growing as you read him?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question about him because he does have his familiars, you know, Orwell and Auden and Middlemarch, and there is this kind of bank of literary references that he comes back to over and over again, including some that he has mixed feelings about, like Graham Greene. It's fair to say that he has this kind of literary endowment that he draws on a lot, and he brings them to bear on every new thing that he writes about. He doesn't feel, fusty or antiquated. I think he's applying them to contemporary events intelligently. I didn't come through this thinking that he wasn't actually paying attention and learning new things from the books that he read. I mean, there is, for example, a review of a book on the Barbary Wars, to which he brings a certain amount of knowledge, but there's clearly this sort of sense of discovery in the essay. And it fascinates him because he sees in the Barbary Wars a kind of precursor of the current war against what he likes to call Islamofascism. He clearly is studying while he's reviewing.
You have already made the transition to columnist in the Sunday magazine, New York Times magazine. You'll be doing it on the op-ed page. Mm-hmm. When you read Hitchens, is this someone you learn from? Does he do a different thing? Is he a master of this particular form of argued opinion? How do you look at him as a writer?
I think anybody who writes columns can learn from Hitchens. I think I would not try to be Hitchens. I mean, my own approach to essay writing is much more ambivalent. I think there is a kind of room for a kind of creative ambivalence in column writing, where you actually start out not with a declaration but with a question and try to report your way through the arguments on both sides or various sides and reach a conclusion. And it can be a conclusion that contains a certain amount of humility and uncertainty because life is complicated and I don't come down with hammer and tongs conviction on every subject. Hitchens does, but you can learn a lot about the art of rhetoric watching him put together an essay. You can, I think, only be in awe of his erudition. I mean, that library that he has in his head and his ability to apparently go back and read at a fantastic rate of speed so that he's sort of mastered the subject. That's something that I could aspire to but don't expect to achieve.
Last question, unexpected developments. Christopher Hitchens's cancer. He was in this studio doing a podcast just days before he learned about this. Is there any strain of sorrow or contemplation or nostalgia, anxiety that runs through this book as well? Is this a subject he's writing about in this collection at all?
Only glancingly. It's hard to tell because as the reviewer, you know that the man is dying. It's hard to tell how much of that you bring to the book and how much of it is actually there. And there's always with Hitchens this sense that he's writing not only for the immediate audience, but for the jury of history. I did sense in this book that that was a little more so, that he was, you know, writing with a sense that he wanted this work to be on the shelf and reviewed and judged after he was gone. Maybe that's just, you know, my eyes.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
You're welcome.
That's Bill Keller, who reviews arguably essays by Christopher Hitchens in this week's book review. Jennifer Schuessler is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Sam.
Well, this is a somber moment for New Yorkers especially, but really the entire nation. It's the 10th anniversary of September 11th. You took a look at the bestseller list, and what did you find in the aftermath of that cataclysmic event?
Well, I was thinking back to that time, and I was very curious to see what was on the bestseller list before the attacks and what was on there after. And it was quite interesting. I mean, with respect to the hardcover list, there, you know, these are new books that have just been brought out. The publishers certainly had no inkling this event was coming. So it actually took a while for that list to change. Actually, the first sort of 9/11 related book, you might say, that appeared was Germs, a book about biological warfare by three New York Times reporters, including Judith Miller. And that book popped up on the list that tracked sales ending the week of September 22nd. So, you know, people were quite interested in this. And as you remember, there was a whole anthrax scare going on. Five people died. A bunch of journalists, including Judith Miller, received envelopes with suspicious white powder. So this was something that Americans really wanted to know about. And also, it seems we really wanted to know a little bit more about who these people that attacked us were. Ahmed Rashid's study Taliban popped up pretty quickly on the paperback list. This was a scholarly book by a journalist published by Yale University Press.
Which I read, as many others did at the time.
Yes. And also another book by a journalist, Yosef Badansky's Bin Laden, also started climbing the list. Now, not everybody was very happy to see that Americans were suddenly reading up on Islam. On October 5th, you know, roughly 3 weeks after the attacks, Liz Cheney, the wife of the vice president, gave a speech in Dallas warning that Americans who were picking up all of these books about Islam and the Muslim world were probably missing the point of the attacks. She warned that this would sort of feed into this perception that September 11th was caused by the fact that Americans didn't know enough about Islam, as opposed to the fact that the hijackers who flew the planes into the World Trade Center were themselves drawing the wrong lessons from Islam. She did say this, you know, that studying other cultures is an important requirement. These are her words. But it was important on September 10th. To say that it is more important now implies that the events of September 11th were our fault, that it was our failure. And she thought instead that what we really needed to do was go back and read our own history and celebrate our own values.
It's so interesting because this really does raise one of the complications, really glorious complications of literature, which is that there is kind of an active sympathy in reading about the other side, even if it's an enemy or adversary in this case. I remember reading Budiansky's book on Bin Laden for an article I wrote for Vanity Fair on American intelligence at the time because I wanted to know more, and most Americans did. And some will remember that in the first aftermath of the attacks, President Bush himself encouraged a kind of solidarity, a global solidarity. That was really one of the great moments in America. So it's interesting to see there was this undertow right from the start of resistance to books like these and to looking outside ourselves.
And, you know, as you may recall, too, pretty soon the mood shifted. And then there was this whole question of whether we were going to invade Iraq. And I went and looked at what was on the list at the one-year anniversary of the attacks. And it was quite interesting. I think Liz Cheney would have been a lot happier. The list that was published on September 15th, 2002, the hardcover list, 11 of the 15 books concerned 9/11 in one way or another. And the number one book in America was Let's Roll by Lisa Beamer. Recall, she was the widow of Todd Beamer, who was on Flight 93 that crashed in Pennsylvania. At number two, we had Sean Hannity, Let Freedom Ring. And at number four, Ann Coulter, Slander. And on the children's book list, Lynn Cheney had a book. It was called America, and it was a patriotic primer.
Jenny, you mentioned there was this outpouring of very patriotic, kind of nationalistic literature that dominated the bestseller list just a little while later. What about interest in Islam? Had that just ebbed, or were people still reading about this religion and its culture?
Not entirely. I was sort of amused to see that a few years later, 2004, 2005, we started getting books like Islam for Dummies or The Quran for Dummies. And in fact, John Updike, in an interview with Rachel Donadio in the book review, said that he had actually consulted The Quran for Dummies when he was writing his 9/11 novel, Terrorist.
Thanks so much, Jenny.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.